This is day four of this November 2014 7-day session, and we'll resume reading from the early Zen texts from Dunhuang Caves, from a book called Zen Dawn, translated by J.C. Cleary. We are working our way through the earliest of the Zen masters. We left off yesterday with Bodhidharma. I think so. All right. Now, this is his successor, Wei Ke. Wei Ke, you'll remember, is the monk who came to Bodhidharma and pleaded for his teaching, and Bodhidharma tested him by saying, "You're too arrogant, and how can you, a mind like yours, benefit from my teaching?" And so the legend has it that Wei Ke then cut off his forearm and stood there in the snow all night, and then this proved to Bodhidharma his sincerity, and then he eventually became Bodhidharma's successor. The one who took it up after the Chan master Bodhidharma was the Chan master Wei Ke. At the age of 14, he met Bodhidharma, who was traveling and teaching in the region. Wei Ke served him for 6 years, investigating the one vehicle with pure energy and drawing near to the abstruse inner truth. The abstruse inner truth. How abstruse could it be when Zen Master Dogen, when he returned from 9 years of training in China, where he had come to enlightenment, was asked what he'd realized, and he said that my eyes are horizontal, my nose is vertical. Some abstruse inner truth. Wei Ke gave an outline account of cultivating the path and of the essential method for illuminating mind. The Lankavatara Sutra says, "Shakyamuni contemplated in stillness and thus left birth and death far behind." This is called not grasping. Of all the enlightened ones of the ten directions, past and present, there is not one who became Buddha without a basis in sitting meditation. The Ten Stages Sutra says, "Within the bodies of sentient beings, there is an indestructible enlightened nature." Sentient beings, again, always in these texts, when you hear sentient beings, it means so-called unenlightened beings. "Within the bodies of sentient beings, there is an indestructible enlightened nature. It is like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright, round, and full. Its light, vast and boundless." Talking, of course, about our essential nature, our Buddha nature. So he describes it this way, but then we have Zen Master Mumon in the Mumon Kan saying, you picture it in vain, you describe it to no avail. The problem with this kind of a description, its body, it's this orb of the sun, its body is bright, round, and full, is that it sets up an image in the mind. And just as our true nature is beyond any words, it's beyond any images. Any way we picture our true nature can't be it. If it can be pictured, and if it can be described, then it's not it. monk once asked Zen Master Zhao Zhou, Joshu, where should the mind of the monk place his attention? And Zhao Zhou said, where there is no design. No outline, no image, no picture, no words. But we have words like mu. But there the challenge, our mission is to see what the spirit, the essence of it, and not get caught in the word. But we do that by focusing, concentrating on the word mu until we have seen through it. Again, Wei Ke continues. This is still quoting the sutra, referring to our true nature. Because it is covered over by the layered clouds of the five skandhas, sentient beings do not see it. The five skandhas we refer to every time we chant the Prajnaparamita. Form, feeling, and so forth. Form, different forms, different appearances, obscure the essential nature of this mind. Feelings obscure the essential nature, and so do the other skandhas. If you encounter the wind of wisdom, it blows away the five skandhas. When the layers of clouds are totally gone, the enlightened nature is shining perfectly bright, clear, and pure. And I think this is supposed to be still Wei Ke quoting yet another sutra, the Huayan Sutra. It is as vast as the universe, as ultimate as the void. But it is also like a light in a jar that cannot illuminate the outside. Then Wei Ke says another simile is this. When clouds close in on all sides and the world is darkened, how can the sunlight be bright and clear? But the sunlight has not been destroyed. It is just covered over and blocked off by the clouds. The pure, true nature of sentient beings is also like this. It cannot become fully manifest precisely because layers upon layers of clouds, afflictions, the perceptions of false thoughts clinging to objects, cover over and block off the path of the sages. If false thoughts are not born and you sit in silent purity, the sun of great nirvana is spontaneously bright and clear. Here when he mentions a couple of ways to understand clouds, he says afflictions, and the perceptions of false thoughts clinging to objects. So what this means is that we don't see things as they are. Instead, we see them filtered through our notions and ideas. We don't see people as they are. We see them filtered through our notions and ideas. And same with everything. How can we remove the filter? Or if not remove it, at least see through it. We know how. Through the breath, through the koans, through shikantaza. It's ancient methods, ancient methods. Going back to Bodhidharma and before, methods for seeing through the filter, the mind filter. And then Weka quotes what he says is a worldly book, could be a Confucian text. That's often when they say worldly in these Chinese texts, they're referring to Confucianism. A worldly book says, ice is born from water, but ice can block water. Ice is solid, whereas water flows. That's the end of the quote. And then Wei Ke says, similarly, falsity arises from the real, and falsity can lose the real in delusion. When falsity is ended, the real appears. The mind see is clear and pure. The body of reality is empty and clean. Again, he's talking about the filter of thoughts, which comes from our true nature and can obscure our true nature. When falsity, that is the mind filter, is ended, the thought filter, when falsity is ended, the real appears. Again, we don't have to end thoughts. We just have to see through them, see the emptiness of them. Therefore, when practitioners rely on written and spoken words as the path, these are like a lamp in the wind. They cannot dispel darkness, and their flame dies away. But if practitioners sit in purity without concerns, it is like a lamp in a closed room. It can dispel the darkness, and it illuminates things with clarity. Without concerns, to sit without concerns. This basically means self-concerns. Concerns wrapped around the notion of a self. Anything where we can see the I or the my is self-concerns. And that's pretty much everything that comes up when we're sitting. If you completely comprehend the clear purity of the mind source, then all vows are fulfilled, all practices are completed, all is accomplished. You are no longer subject to states of being. For those who find this body of reality, the Dharmakaya, the numberless sentient beings are just one good person. The one person who has been there in accord with this through a million billion eons. One good person. This is who Lin Chi was described as a person of no rank. It's what the Siddhartha himself referred to when he took seven steps, raised one hand, lowered the other, said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one. I alone in which no one is not included. If pure energy and true integrity are not generated within you, it accomplishes nothing even if you encounter countless Buddhas, past, present, and future. That is, even if you encounter countless enlightened ones. Thus we know that sentient beings liberate themselves by knowing mind. The Buddhas do not liberate sentient beings. If the Buddhas could liberate sentient beings, since we have met countless Buddhas in the past, why haven't we become enlightened? It is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. Unless the mind attains what the mouth speaks of, you will never avoid taking on form according to your deeds. That is, you will never stop creating karma for yourself. So this, his reference to generating pure energy and true integrity. Let's just take a quick look at this. Generating pure energy, well, both of these, and true integrity, are accomplished by becoming absolutely absorbed in this, single-mindedly in this one practice that we're working on. To the degree that we can single-mindedly concentrate on this one practice, we will find energy in abundance. Because so much of our energy is actually sapped by thinking, dwelling in thoughts. So the more concentrated we are on just this one matter of our practice, the mu, and so forth, the more energy we will find building. The more, which just means more energy is available. It's not being siphoned off into thoughts. This is what the Japanese call jōriki. The energy that that comes from concentrated mind. And true integrity, same thing. It comes from integrating our attention, integrating the mind on this one matter, rather than scattering the mind. Comes from collecting the mind, bringing together, concentrating. It's like magic, really. We don't have to make an assignment out of this. We just have to absorb ourselves in this one practice, and then the energy grows. We become integrated, whole. Wei Ke continues, thus enlightened nature is like sun and moon to the world. Within wood there is the potential for fire. Within humans there is an enlightened true identity. It is also called the lamp of Buddha nature and the mirror of nirvana. The great nirvana mirror is brighter than sun and moon. Inside and out, it is perfectly pure, boundless, and infinite. He's talking, of course, about every one of us. This is our nature. Another simile is smelting gold. When the dross is obliterated, the pure gold is unharmed. When the forms or the notions of sentient beings and birth and death are obliterated, the body of reality is unharmed. Accomplishment in sitting meditation is experienced by oneself within one's own body. Thus, a picture of a cake is not fit for a meal. Of course, he's talking about the difference between reading or conceptualizing about the Dharma and experiencing it directly. Thus, a picture of a cake is not fit for a meal. If you speak of feeding it to other people, how can it satisfy them? Though you wish to remove the blockages of the past, instead you make the future offshoots even stronger. The YN Sutra says, it is like being a poor man day and night counting the treasures of others without having a single penny of his own. So, again, the reading about, the hearing about, not the thing, not the direct experience, but about, is what he's warning about. Being learned is also like this. Moreover, those who read should only look at books for a while, then hasten to put them away, to test them in practice. If you do not give them up, it is the same as verbal learning. This is no different from looking for ice by boiling water. This advice is still as sound today as ever. I offer it at introductory workshops. There's a place for reading. The primary place for reading is to kickstart a stalled practice, but really it's the real what reading can give us is just to the inspiration to put aside the book and actually do the practice. And now we're moving right along to Wei Ko's successor, Sung San, the fourth ancestor, known as the fourth ancestor and the author of Affirming Faith and Mind. The one who took it up after the Chan Master Wei Ko was the Chan Master Sung San. He concealed himself on Si Kong Mountain, living in solitude, sitting in purity. That word purity keeps coming up in these texts, and maybe it's worth mentioning that there are different ways of sitting, even in the same posture. We can sit and just be sifting through thoughts, memories, ideas. That's not the sitting. that these masters are referring to are talking about sitting in purity. Sitting in purity is this true zazen, unstained by thoughts, beyond thought. But that's a very advanced state. Until we reach that state, we have to grope our way through the thoughts and avoid getting entangled in them. And yet we keep getting caught in them. So then we go back to the practice, and little by little it does get better. We find a way not to be drawn into our thoughts. It says here, he did not put any writings into circulation. He taught only intimately at close range and did not publicly transmit the Dharma. And yet, he's considered the author of Affirming Faith and Mind, one of the preeminent Zen texts ever. I wonder what that means then, that someone else record it and get it into circulation. He had only one known disciple, the monk Dao Xun, who served him for 12 years. Thus did Sun Tzu fashion the vessel and transmit the lamp, complete in every respect. He certified Dao Xun's complete perception of Buddha nature. Here's an odd little nugget embedded in here. The great teacher Sun Tzu said, "Everyone else thinks it is noble to die while sitting. They sigh at such a marvel. Now I will die standing, independent of birth and death." And then, his words finished, he held on to the branch of a tree as his breath gently ended. There is only the vast depths of the one reality. Ah, for the profuse diversity of the myriad forms. True and conventional differ, but their essential body is the same. Ordinary and sage are divided, but the path joins them. If we look for a shore, it is vast and boundless, stretching out of sight to infinity. It takes its source in the beginningless and reaches its limit in the endless. There's some people still not mature in their practice who hear something like this shore, the other shore. He's referring to the other shore of supreme awakening. That it stretches to infinity, it reaches its limit in the endless, and they can be disconsolate. Oh, great, I'm trying to get to the other shore, and yet you say it just is ever receding. But you can also see it as a marvelous thing, that how could this matter, this great matter, be of any true worth if it's something we could just accomplish and check off, done. He's talking about supreme, perfect enlightenment. Something we can grow toward endlessly. How wonderful. There's a saying in Zen, even Shakyamuni is only halfway there. We must abandon the notion of this being a thing we need to get to. It's a limited way of understanding this great journey. That's what's wrong with these forms of practice that come around every few years, where the proponents will say, well, I remember back in the 70s, it was 3 days to Kensho, and other ridiculous claims. Just a short time, and then you've got it. Then you're done. What can you develop in yourself in 3 days? What strengthening of character and development, refining of personality can you do in 3 days? It's an outlandish claim. Even without reaching any kind of supposed endpoint, we are continuously developing ourselves. This is really what this is all about. There's another Zen saying, if you think you've gone all the way, keep going. You only get it when you're halfway there. We have to accept, make peace with the work itself, which can become a joy. And it's more likely to be a joy if we're not postulating some end point that we have yet to reach, but just lose ourselves in the moment through the practice. I'm skipping here a bit. Some of this, I can see is directly off the scrolls from the Dunhuang caves. The translator seems to have been true to the original and not really editing it much. Says an infinitesimally small space contains all the phenomena of the great thousand world system. An instant of time includes all the times of past, present, and future. Here are a couple of neat similes. When the monkey wears chains, he stops his restless movement. When the snake enters a tube, he straightens out his curves. Cross the vast sea with a boat of discipline. Illuminate the thick darkness with a lamp of wisdom. So the monkey wearing chains is pretty much us in Sesshin. the structure is such that we don't have a lot of room to thrash around. We have to sit and face the mind directly. The snake entering a tube is a metaphor for concentration. Concentration bringing an end to confusion. And he quotes some treatise, the Perfection of Wisdom treatise says, "The way a snake moves is naturally crooked, but when it enters a tube, it straightens out. The way samadhi controls the mind is also like this." We come to Sesshin to get straightened out, to sit straight, straighten out the mind, in order to see the mind as it is. It's only when we exercise this kind of discipline that we can really see beyond the limitations of this body-mind. I'm reminded of Wynton Marsalis's, the trumpeter, who said, "There's no freedom in freedom, man. There's only freedom in structure." We do have a great entry into freedom, paradoxically, through this structure and discipline of Sesshin, and even outside Sesshin, through the structure and discipline of the sitting posture, or through residential training. This is how we can experience real freedom, freedom from this restless, craving mind of ours. It's worked for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. We can make it work for us. It does take commitment. It takes effort. Perseverance. Times we feel like nothing's happening. We're not getting anywhere. Don't believe that. Trust the process. If you stop and doubt, then that's not trusting the process, and it's not going to work as well. To a large extent, it does come down to trust. Trusting this ancient, simple method. Trusting it enough to apply oneself to it wholly. Not holding back. Not checking to see if about results. That all just impedes the results. It's the irony of this practice. We don't have to think about the practice. We just have a word. We have the breath. We have the koan. That's all. That's all we need. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.